in the studio with us to review some of those agenda items. Superintendent Amber Conley, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
First off, we've got a number of community meetings, those happening one at 9 today and then later on at 6, talking specifically about the district learning plan.
You got it. We have our last for the year community forums, just really as a state of the district, and to review where we are with the district learning plan, make sure the community is aware of what that entails and some of the changes that we're making.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the district learning plan, we've been talking about it. I still don't really get what it is. Is it something required by the state of Utah that we implement?
Not specifically.
So it's something you kind of brought with yourself from Arizona.
And it's actually, when you look at education as a whole and what the pieces that you have to have in place to have a highly effective district, it is one of those pieces that needs alignment between the strategic plan and our school improvement plans.
So those two plans are required. So this is kind of like
Our school improvement plans are required by the state. However, the strategic plan, that's just good planning for the entire district.
All right. So the district learning plan, it's what, broken down into each of the schools in terms of what you need to do?
Right. And we call this the loose, tight fit. So when I say that, it means that there are some overarching goals within the district learning plan, making sure that we're reaching the needs of our low-performing students at grade level, and then at the same time looking at our grade level and high-performing students and pushing them to higher levels. And within that, then, are the questions really asking, what do our kids need to learn? How do we know they've learned it? And what are we doing if they have learned it or if they haven't learned it? And so it really defines a district focus, but yet it is up to the individual schools to determine how they reach those.
All right. So it's going to require, though, some training by everybody. And what you're calling it is that the theory of professional learning communities. So what does that mean?
This was brought probably in the late 90s by a researcher, DeFore. And he was actually a principal, and he used collaborative teaming. And it's not even, I would say, you know, professional learning communities. It's known throughout education. But what it does is it puts teachers into teams using data and looking at our students and what they need and helping teachers collaborate within those to reach our students.
So this doesn't come at any small cost.
You know, it's been interesting because what we've been able to do is look, for instance, at our curriculum, our current curriculum budget, and really reorganize that. Of course, there is some, and I'm going to get into that here in just a minute. I want to share that with you because of a couple other factors regarding growth and what we need to do specifically at Ecker Hill. We have added 4.5 full-time employees, and that isn't necessarily attached to anything that we're doing with the district learning plan.
That's just dealing with student growth. Got it.
Right.
But when you start talking about collaboration, you're talking about going from a 3-bell schedule to a 2-bell schedule.
Right. And it's interesting when you look at what needs really to happen for teachers to be able to collaborate and also to align, and I'm going to use some educational jargon, to align the curriculum. For instance, our fifth grade teachers need to meet with our sixth grade teachers, and right now it's really impossible. One within the contract, but also for them within the school day to do that.
So you're proposing that we go again from 3 bells to 2 bells, but that comes at a cost of buying new buses, having kids on the bus for maybe up to an hour, hiring new bus drivers, and hiring instructional we're talking about almost 8 full-time employees to pull this off.
So with the full-time, the instructional coaches that you referenced right at the end, we had 3 full-time positions at the secondary schools and then half-time coaches at the other schools. So what we've done is we've shuffled some positions that were held out of the district office and cut those positions to be able to allow us to have full-time instructional coaches at each building.
So you're just saying it's just a wash there?
That one's a wash. With the buses, this is I always believe in putting higher numbers on things, because then when it comes back at a lower number, it makes really everyone happy. But looking at the number of buses that we would need, it would be a cost of about $600,000 in capital. And then looking specifically at our routes and efficiency of our bus drivers and our bus routes and the databases that we're using, it would cost probably anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 extra a year to be able to do the two schedules.
Yeah. I think teachers, you know, would say, though, you know what, we collaborate and we do it around the copy machine.
And actually, I might disagree with you. I was actually at Ecker this last Friday, and the thought of going to a two schedule, they were ecstatic. And it also gets into the cost of how much we're spending with professional development and the different contract times to be able to pull them out. And the different bell schedules for our parents and being able to have, I mean, we have families, of course, that have several children in different buildings, and it's management is hard for that.
So how often are they collaborating? And I guess, is that worth having, you know, anybody sitting on a bus for 58 minutes?
And I'll go back to the 58 minutes. The highest bus route that we've come in this far is 54 minutes, so that is a valid concern. However, I will tell you, and this probably comes back from a little bit of my background, that there is a lot more efficiencies that we can be taking. Some of our buses right now only have, let's say, 15 to 20 kids, and we have a capacity of 68 available for them on a bus. So there's some efficiencies that we need to take care of.
Again, but that doesn't lower the time on a bus. And we're talking 54 minutes in the morning and 54 minutes in
the
afternoon.
That's the top, yep.
Yeah. So how are you going to weigh those? I mean, what's more important?
There's a lot of discussion that still needs to happen.
Okay. So when you hope to have this implemented, what, by next school year?
Where we are right now with the budget, we are having a work session tomorrow morning. As you know, that's why I'm here. And one of the areas that we're specifically looking at is next year's cost, but also costs over the next 5 years and what that looks like. And specifically looking at our district learning plan and what that means incrementally as we reach to that next 5 years.
Well, looking at that, the future actually looking pretty bleak. As of next school year, we're already running deficiencies of $3 million, and those just grow by more than $3 million each year. So what's the plan to deal with that?
There's some variables in place. One is, and every business is facing this right now, is the cost of insurance. And specifically for Park City School District, we had a 14% cost of insurance, which you usually, in the world of insurance, usually put in as a projection anywhere from, like, let's say 8 to 10, so that when we received the 14% back, it was not what we had anticipated. So that is a very large chunk of change that we didn't anticipate. The other pieces that are in place, because, as you know, the licensed professional agreement and how we restructured the salary schedule along with the endorsements, we had to project how many teachers would have those endorsements, because for every endorsement we pay an X amount of dollars. And so right now we're trying to create the baseline of what that would be for this year to be able to project for the next 3 years. So when I say there's lots of variables, those are two major variables in place.
Yeah. Well, let's talk, I mean, because we've got another number of open houses coming up for talented and gifted students. And I think a lot of this coming from pressure from parents who think that their kids may not be getting enough attention. So what, we're going to put somebody in each of the schools to, what, pull these kids out and give them special treatment? Or?
Great question. So throughout the process, when I came in at the beginning, pulling data and looking at the needs of the district, there were some areas that really needed to be addressed, and one was our gifted and talented program. We do, and it's interesting, working in other districts and now coming to Park City, we do have a higher than average, truly gifted population. So when I say that, that is measured by a test called COGAT, and you take the top 3%, so they have to score a 97% or higher to really be designated, or for no better word, labeled as a gifted child. But then you look at the students that had even scored from 93% and above. It's a much higher percentage in the Park City School District than what's seen throughout the nation. And also, as you know, when you look at our scores, for the most part, we have 90%. For instance, we have an elementary school that 90% of the students are performing at the 90% level. And that just shows that we have some very bright students that need to be challenged at a different level. So what I've put in place for this next year is we've already hired one full-time gifted and talented specialist. So what that does is it puts one full-time gifted and talented specialist at Ecker, and then it splits two people between the four elementaries, providing a half-time gifted and talented. And they receive two types of instruction. One is a pull-out model where the students actually are taken out of the classroom and provided different project. It's usually project-based learning around their strength. And then we also use what's called a step-in model, where our gifted and talented specialists or coaches work directly with that classroom teacher in the classroom. They plan together. And it really takes, and you hear this, differentiation, but it takes differentiation to a higher level where we really are able to do small groups and to meet the needs of the students.
Yeah. So we're getting money from the Education Foundation to pay for some of the help here. Who pays, what about the future? Who's going to pay to continue this?
That's a good question. So when I looked at the amount of money that we received from the state, and I want to go back, I'm going to go back to your first question about the $3 million or the $2.5 million offset. One thing that isn't real clear is that the cost that it takes to educate a child in Park City with everything that we have is $10,000. And of that, we receive about $3,000 from the state. So as you see, just for every student, we're having to supplement roughly $7,000 for each student. And that's where, of course, the taxes, property tax comes in. So going back to how are we paying for this? One is through the growth model, we were able to place one full-time employee through our current budget. The Park City Ed Foundation, and we had a great event this last weekend, have already raised close to $100,000 to put one more specialist in, but their goal is two, which would put a specialist at each and every elementary. We have until June the 1st to raise those funds, and the idea is that we collect that baseline data and see to be able to show that this is a program that not only helps our high-achieving but also our grade level and below-achieving students, because it raises the rigor in the classroom.
So are we talking about helping the top 7% or the top 3%?
Right. So really, when you look at the model that we're using, you are actually reaching the top 25% with the model that we're using. So you really are reaching more students than just that small portion that's tested. But then you look at just the ability for the teacher within the classroom to be able to differentiate. You begin reaching within the elementary close to 80% of your students.
Yeah. You also have the Ed Foundation paying the $41,000 salary for the dual language immersion social studies teacher at Ecker Hill. Again, going back to the budget, who's going to pay for that next year?
Right. So through the dual language immersion review this last year, we felt it necessary to have that support with the dual language immersion at Ecker. Because now we've had some movement, some transitions, as we project for the next 3 years, that will be taken into the Ecker Hill full-time employee allocation. Yeah. So this is a one-time only.
Yeah. And again, this is before you came, but, we had gone into similar deficiencies as we're seeing on the five-year budget here, didn't do a whole lot about it, but then came back, raised taxes, made a bunch of cuts. But with higher class sizes, new programs, new bus schedules, how are we going to pay for all of this without getting into the similar situation?
Right. So some of the other areas that we've looked at is really some of the excess that we've had, and changing models to be more efficient. So when I say that, we had some district-level positions, half-time positions, that we've eliminated. So we have shifted that. We've looked specifically at all the budgets that we've have allocated, let's just say, to the individual site levels, and we've cut 25% of those to be able to really reach all of our students. And on top of that, we've looked at the reading program and the cost that's associated with our reading program versus what we were receiving. And there's going to be some pretty major changes to it over the next couple of years.
Yeah, but ideally, you're a lot better off keeping half-time people because you're not having to pay benefits for them.
Not necessarily, not with the health care, the new health care Affordable Health Care Act. We are required to be able to provide them with health insurance.
Above 20 hours.
Yes. And half-time, most of our half-time positions weren't that.
They were more than that?
Right.
All right. So you seem pretty confident that we don't have any budget woes here. I mean, when you look at the line items going on, I mean, we've got some serious deficits that's coming up.
We have, and I guess maybe one of the reasons that I feel really confident is that, one, it's just the first year of really looking at each line item. I just go back to the initial curriculum budget because I'm most familiar with curriculum and how to run a curriculum department extremely efficient. We've made some significant changes there, and I see through the next 2-3 years as I become more familiar, as Todd Haber, the business administrator, and I work hand in hand, which we do already, and really look at what's best for kids and put that at the forefront, I think you're going to see some pretty remarkable changes. It really is some of the unknowns that has within our projections, like I keep saying, our health insurance costs, the cost of our endorsements. We do have several retirees coming up. However, we have new people coming in, which that means more training for them as we look at their first 3 years. So, and our district is growing. I think that we need to keep that at the forefront as well. It costs $10,000 to educate them. We have to supplement $7,000 per child.
So it sounds like more tax increases are on the way.
And I'm going to be really honest. I really can't say yes or no on that one.
All right. Finally, scheduled to hear some recommendations from the Master Planning Commission committee. Still didn't see anything in the packet. Who is the Master Plan Committee? Because my understanding, it's just really staff,
right?
District office. There's
right.
Nobody from the public on this committee.
So what we have is throughout, when you look at district, what's required by policy to have certain committees. So there are certain district committees that the school board appoints, and then, of course, there's certain committees that are held within the district. The master planning does have two governing board members on that committee, along with staff members. So you're dead on. And this has been a major learning process for me, just as where we were with the master planning and how we got to where we are currently. So back in 2010, there was an audit done of all of our facilities. And then a plan was put in place. When I say a plan, it's basically a large booklet with every single facility that determines life expectancy of each building, and then created a priority list. And so with that, that is where we are right now with the list. The initial project that was slated in that audit was the need for a professional development building, one, because our district office is not designed at its best, and the life expectancy of that building needed to be extended. And so there was the original plan for professional development, and then also to look at our career and tech ed programs. And then that's where PC caps came in, and I'm sure that you might have heard the controversy or maybe even just concerns of why PC caps. It was part of the last 4 years of research and then implementing a program to really enhance college and career readiness. Hence, that's where we are right now. So it would house in the current state, and again, this is at the board level right now for discussion, a professional development center along with an area for our PC caps, but it was designed with flexible rooms. That isn't the right architectural term. But as we look at, we've been working with Mr. O'Connor just in the last couple months at our other programs of what we could possibly house there, and also looking at a blended learning model, putting, you know, the big computer labs and having that access for them, and do some really innovative STEM education. So it is a building that could be easily added onto, nor would it get in place of when, and I'm going to say when we have to do something with Treasure. because that is a much larger building and a much higher cost in capital.
So is that the recommendation then to go forward with that $5 million building?
The recommendation from the master planning is that we're presenting that to the board right now with the information we've gathered through the concepts. And again, I'm learning architectural terms, the concepts presented by VCBO, who is and was through the process the determined architects for just the concepts.
Yeah. So it seems like what I'm hearing is that instead of calling it the PC Caps building, now we're calling it the professional development building. Maybe that's to try and, you know, assuage some of the concern here. And I think that concern comes to what we've got is a unproven program. You know, we've had 1.5 semesters of this program. And does it really just go the way that the International Baccalaureate or PSYOP, I guess, is headed, or Algebra 2 or the CRT test? I mean, it's... You know, why spend? So it's really, you're saying it's a professional development building first, and PC Caps can use it.
You know, you've hit really a lot of the concerns that we've heard from the community. And I'm actually excited about the process, because what it does, it just opens the transparency of, one, where education is headed towards, and what we can really do to enhance our students' education. But the one thing I know that we have to be very cautious with is that when we design a building, that it is flexible to meet the needs of our students regardless of the program. And when I say that, again, looking at the high school, looking at Treasure Mountain and some of the programs that we can move over into that building, looking at forensics, looking at debate, really creating an environment for even those two programs for our students to learn, looking at the biotech fields of the medical side. So I see this building as maybe initially being able to serve those two programs, but in the end, it's going to be a multi-use, multi-service building.
I'm going to say, you know, with some kids on perhaps on a bus for almost 2 hours a day, maybe we need to think of some program for them.
And I keep saying blended learning, but I really am excited with the opportunities that we have within STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, with the work that we're doing with University of Utah, USU, and of course UVU, of what we can offer our students.
Okay, Amber, anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope, just a reminder that we do have a community forum here in about 25 minutes at district office, and we also have one tonight at 6 p.m. at Jeremy Ranch Elementary School.
Okay, Amber, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
That's Superintendent of Park City Schools, Amber Conley. KPCW News Time now, 8:35.